right, y'all. Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. I'm Tux Lurzel.
I have to sneeze.
Oh, I was like, did you forget your name?
No, I'm not going to sneeze. Wow. Stephanie Domingo.
Ta-da.
I thought I was going to sneeze, you guys. Sorry for making it weird.
We be drinking and we be swearing and sneezing.
Well.
Or not sneezing.
Not sneezing.
Holding in a sneeze. This is a show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics or government.
Yes.
And government, whichever you choose.
You know, up to you. We're not your boss.
So, today, we are drinking a fancy-ass Prohibition-era cocktail called a Monkey Gland.
What?
It is called the Monkey Gland.
No, it's not.
It sure is.
You chose a drink called the Monkey Gland?
I sure did.
What gland?
You'll find out.
Okay.
So, I chose this, A, because it's period appropriate, it's Prohibition era. Stephanie's scandal is Prohibition era adjacent.
Era, yeah, definitely.
And this is our October episode.
Oh.
So I thought this one was kind of
Oktoberfest.
Halloween-y.
Yes.
This would be Halloween-y because this
Monkey
cocktail
plant
is based on basically a mad scientist.
Wow, that's very appropriate.
So
very, very appropriate.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
So in the 1910s and 1920s, there was this Russian-born surgeon in France named Dr. Sergei Voronov,
who... He's also a mixologist?
Well, no. The cocktail came later, but it's,
okay.
It's sort of like named after his work.
Okay.
So he had this theory that the sex glands of ligging... Jesus Christ, I've had, like, I haven't even taken a sip yet. We didn't have a drink before.
You've had a whisper of gin.
Yeah, exactly. A whisper of gin.
Whisper.
So, he believed that the sex glands of living organisms held the key to health, vigor, and longevity.
Wow.
So, basically, long story short, Dr. Sergei Voronov grafted the testicles of monkeys onto his patients.
I know about this.
You do?
Kind of, sort of.
Yeah.
There were other people who were doing this as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, some serious mad scientist shit. So his work got really super famous, apparently. There were copycats. I didn't know about that.
Yeah, in the U.S.
But, like, everyone knew about it. Everyone knew about it. His work was like, everyone was talking about it. It was all in the news. It was everywhere. It was also very expensive. I think it was like $5,000 for the procedure in 1920.
So what would the procedure, it would help you?
No, it didn't do shit.
No, okay.
But he insisted that it would give, that, okay, so it says, by 1927, he did over 1,000 procedures.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Promising, quote, a lifespan of 125 years and an old age of a few months. He really thought that people just weren't going to age until they were about to die at 125 years old.
Was this man like a real doctor or was he
Dr.
Nick?
He wrote books. He was like, yes. In the beginning,
he wasn't
very
a doctor.
Yes. The B is for bargain.
He was a real doctor. Yes. He believed that people wouldn't age. They would only...
Because the monkey glands, monkey testicles, held the key to longevity.
I mean, they were throwing a lot of things against the wall
back
then.
It was the 20s.
It was the 20s, yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So he got these, I think it was like $5,000 per procedure in the 20s. And so rich people were traveling from all over the world to go to France to get fucking monkey testicles sewn onto their bodies.
Okay, so what happened to their real testicles?
It wasn't like they were putting monkey testicles.
Replacing them.
Yeah, they were just, I don't know where on their body, but like under the skin somewhere. They would just like sew some monkey testicles under your skin.
Okay, so this is different than what I was thinking of.
Oh, okay.
I thought it was a replacement.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, because women would get it too. Yeah. You just had to be rich, basically.
Did it kill people?
I don't think it killed people, but it basically just didn't do anything.
Yeah.
Like, your body...
But take your money.
Yeah, your body would reject it, and then you would have, like, a scar, but that was it. And then he kind of said, like, the scar is proof that it's still there and it's working.
No.
Yeah.
It's proof of a cut.
Yeah, exactly. So eventually people figured out that his shit didn't do shit.
How long did it take for people
It wasn't until the 40s that he was, like... Really
Sorry.
Fully discredited.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he became, basically he was a laughingstock by the 40s.
Wow.
But the whole time in the 20s, when, like, most of his work was done in the 20s, And the media was completely obsessed with him. And everyone was talking about it, which is where this cocktail comes from. He, you know, it's not named after him, but it's named after his procedure. Just because it was so famous and people were like, did you hear that this guy is sewing fucking monkey testicles to people? So they named a cocktail the monkey gland after what he was doing. There's a little bit of a debate over who exactly invented it, where exactly it was invented. Most likely either Paris or London. Probably Paris, but there's some debate. And we don't know exactly when, but it was most likely the very end of the 1910s.
Okay.
There's an article from the New York Times. The headline says, Monkey Gland, Latest Cocktail.
Hmm.
In 1919. And then the article says it contains orange juice, gin, and a dash of absinthe as the principal ingredients. So on top of the whole, like, mad scientist thing, the reason that this cocktail became so popular is also because it contained absinthe, which was banned even outside of the U.S. Even when the U.S. was about to go into prohibition, Europe was banning absinthe too, because there was this whole thinking that
it made you crazy.
It would make you, well, basically it was like psychoactive. They thought it was going to make you trip.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, wormwood does have some psychoactive properties, but you would have to consume so much absinthe to get that psychoactive benefit from the wormwood that you would die of alcohol poisoning way before you ever actually tripped. Like you would, so it's bullshit, but there was basically this kind of like propaganda campaign against absinthe in the 1910s and 20s. So it was banned. And for that reason, people thought like, ooh, it's dangerous. It's forbidden.
Sexy. You know what I
mean? Yeah, exactly. So everyone wanted this cocktail because it's just uses just a tiny touch of absinthe.
It was a rinse too back then?
Or some recipes would say just like a dash of absinthe. The way I make it, you rinse the glass with absinthe and then pour the cocktail in. But it's not actually mixed in. It's just in the glass.
Okay.
An article about it said, and for those who couldn't get their hands on the banned absinthe, bartenders have found anise, a substitute with sufficient kick. But people wanted the absinthe. And there, even though it was banned, some bars still had it. Like little bottles of it left over. And because it used just a little bit, you could make a lot of drinks with just a tiny little bit. Yeah. So everyone was obsessed with the monkey gland in the 20s. Mm. There were articles about it. It was all the rage in Paris, in London.
What a name.
Yeah. And then it came to the U.S. And there was even, besides all these articles about it, there was even a movie.
What?
That was, not about it, but it was featured in this movie. It's actually the first ever Marx Brothers film, which is called The Coconuts. Made in 1929.
Wait, who are the Marx Brothers?
They made a bunch of films in the 30s.
Okay.
The movie The Coconuts features an Irving Berlin song.
The movie's called The Coconuts?
Yeah, it's called The Coconuts. And the song was called The Monkey Doodle Doo.
Yes, already into it.
Let me take you by the hand over to the jungle band. If you're too old for dancing, get yourself a monkey gland and then let's go.
If you're too old for dancing, you just need a monkey gland.
Get yourself a monkey gland. Okay. That's all you need. Yeah. So everyone was fucking obsessed with this cocktail in the 20s. The only notes I have, if you're going to make this at home, it does call for grenadine. Do not
use... Get the real stuff,
you have
right?
to use real grenadine. Don't get the like neon red sugar water from the grocery store. Make sure that you read the ingredients.
Grenadine I knew.
Yeah, I know. Today. No, me too. Until a few years ago.
I'm like, wait, what?
Grenadine has pomegranate juice in it. Yeah. So if the ingredients do not say pomegranate, then it's not real grenadine. So it's really easy to find online, but it's also really easy to make yourself. If you want to make this, it's super easy to make grenadine. Also, the other thing I want to note is that the original recipe called for equal parts of orange juice and gin, but most modern recipes call for 2 parts gin to 1 part orange juice because the orange juice is... It's just such a strong flavor that it kind of kills the drink and makes it too sweet.
Mm.
I made the sort of more contemporary version with less orange juice.
Mm-hmm.
But if you guys out there like really fruity sweet drinks, you would probably want the half and half.
Yeah. So, it's like a tequila sunrise in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Just with a little bit of absinthe and gin instead of tequila. But like the absinthe really elevates it from just like gin and juice.
Yeah.
So shall we cheers?
Let us.
You want to taste this monkey gland?
Cheers.
I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
Hmm, that's delicious.
Yeah.
Monkey gland.
Who knew?
I'm going to order this the next time bars are a thing again.
Yeah. Can I have a monkey gland, please?
I'm going to be like, wait, you don't know how to make a monkey gland? Definitely ties directly into my story.
Really?
Yeah, you'll find out why. So I love Supreme Court scandals, as you know.
Oh, yeah.
The one I have for you this episode, just in time for Halloween, is a real-life horror story.
Ooh.
The 1927 Buck versus Bell case.
I've never heard of that.
Okay, mm-hmm. Yeah. No one has heard of it, really. I didn't know. And my sister, who has, she just graduated law school, didn't know about it.
Okay.
This case hinged upon a state's right to forcibly sterilize a young woman it deemed unfit to have a child.
Oh, my God.
Unfit due to mental deficiencies. Just as a side note, every time I say unfit, there are air quotes around it.
Sure.
Yes.
What did you say? 1927?
27, yes.
Wow. That's some like Hitler shit, Nazi shit. Like,
ooh, we're getting there.
Okay.
We're getting there. And I'm like, I knew that you didn't know this case, but I knew that you would know the background about what was happening on the ground at this time. So the 17-year-old plaintiff, she was only
17?
I mean, at the time of the surgery, she was 21, but 17 is when the state sterilized her because a bunch of assholes said the magic words, feeble-minded.
Oh my fucking God.
Also air quotes around that. So this landmark case should be infamous like Dred Scott, yet no one has heard of it. Like the fact that someone can go through law school and never know about this.
That's insane.
I'll get into this at the end. Everyone should know this case.
Yeah.
So trigger warning to survivors of sexual violence. My scandal involves a rape. I don't go into detail, okay, but it's worth noting up top. Wow. So, with that said, please prepare your minds for fuck shit, because we are talking eugenics.
Jesus Christ. Baby. Happy Halloween.
Okay, so we have to toast.
Oh, yeah.
Let us raise our glasses to yet another dark chapter brushed under the rug of American history. Cheers.
Cheers.
Mm-hmm. So pretty.
That's the most delicious monkey testicle I've ever tasted.
Same. So what do you think of when you hear the word eugenics?
Well,
you probably think of like Kellogg.
Yeah, Kellogg was really,
I'm sorry, I like put words in your mouth. What did you,
no,
what
no, no, you're right though. I mean, I just basically think of like racists, white supremacy, and but also Hitler.
Yeah, and, of course. When I was researching this, I'm like, I know that you know about Kellogg because I learned about him through researching this story. So yeah, I think of Hitler's genocidal quest to create a supposed master race when I think of eugenics. In high school, the eugenics that I learned about had a very distinct, like, foreign undertone. Mm-hmm. This was something that the evil Germans did over there.
Yeah.
But what was missing from our class discussions of Nazi eugenics was the fact that it was us that gave them this fucked up idea in the first place.
Why am I not surprised? I did not know that.
I didn't know that either, yeah. But, like, I gave myself a few seconds, and I'm just like, of course.
Yeah, that makes all the sense.
Yeah. I mean, decades-old eugenics policies here inspired Nazis to launch their own program, which, as we all know, was the precursor to the Holocaust.
Yeah.
I did not know this. I would have remembered this in high school had I learned it.
Yeah.
But we live in a nation founded on white supremacy. Of course, we would be on the cutting edge of some, like, hateful, genocidal bullshit. Of course, we'd have these, like, proto-Aryan thought leaders, air quotes around that, like,
and if you've listened to our last episode, it makes sense that we didn't learn this in schools because we don't talk about that kind of shit.
No, we don't. Yeah, we get an A+ with 2 stickers for our white supremacy.
And our ability to lie to ourselves about our history.
Yeah, but apparently it's our finest export.
Good for us. Literally, gold star.
Gold star.
Wow, okay, fun.
Yeah, we had turd people like Madison Grant. I'm trying to use turd more, you guys.
I know.
It's a word that I've stolen from Tux. I don't know. It just felt so childish, but now it feels fun.
Yeah.
I've embraced the turd lifestyle.
Hashtag turd lifestyle.
Get on our level. So We had we had turd people like Grant. He's like a really shitty man that you've never heard of who's given us a word that we all know a little too well. He talked about the superiority of a race that he made up called the Nordics.
Ooh.
Yes. This make-believe race was the most recently evolved, so their genes were easily diluted by primitive races.
Are you fucking kidding me?
And we know what those primitive races are, don't we?
We sure do.
Yeah.
Well, back then it was like, could have been Italians, yeah, Irish people.
Exactly.
It was. That wasn't, yeah,
it was.
Okay.
It's Jewish. Yeah. Yeah. So this quote-unquote superior race was not yet stable, so it had to be preserved at all costs.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
So it's like, is it superior or is it like weak sauce? Like,
yeah.
Is it,
yeah, so, that sounds,
somehow is it both?
Yeah, like, it's the weakest,
yeah,
like, superior, most vulnerable race, so that makes it the strongest and the most worthy of
Look at you
saving.
Over there trying to think.
I should know better.
Yes. So regardless of this, Hitler wrote a very Stanish letter to Mr. Grant. He wrote, "Your book was my Bible."
Wow.
He wrote a book called The Passing of a Great Race, as we can imagine what that was about.
Wow.
So okay. Just let that sink in.
Uh-huh.
We didn't learn this in high school, did we?
Nope.
Nope.
Never heard of it.
So a little background on eugenics. Even though the movement started within British academia, it became like a social movement. The U.S. was the first country, even though it was a British thing, to make it not just a popular idea, but to institutionalize it into law. In the majority of states.
Wow.
Yeah. I feel like I've already kicked you in the gut and I'm just starting.
I've heard some stories on this podcast.
Okay, that is true. That is true, yeah.
Nothing surprises me anymore.
This is my payback for all
self-specific
of
sadness.
Self-specific stories. Eugenics was rooted in the biological determinist ideas of Sir Francis Galton. Do you know him?
No.
He was the half-cousin of Darwin, oddly enough.
Wow.
He stole a lot of his ideas, but he like didn't think too hard about these ideas that he stole. He thought that humans could control their own evolution, like in real time, through eugenics, a term that he coined in 1883.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, it's bullshit, but it like...
I understand the leap.
Yeah.
So his idea was like pair the most intelligent, the most fit, the most beautiful with each other,
yeah,
and their offspring would boost what he called the human breeding stock.
Sure.
So he believed that differences in a person's ability and status were due mostly to genetics. He thought the elite's social positions and status were because of their genes.
No.
He studied the aristocracy over there. I mean, he said nothing of their privileged environment, their, like, generational wealth, all the nepotism, et cetera, et cetera.
But also, like, what about the fact that a lot of royal families are all sort of inbred because they want to keep... Okay, sorry. But usually they have, like, weaker genetic traits because of that shit,
right? Look at you over here in Fact Town.
Sorry. I'm always jumping the gun.
Join us in Eugenics Village.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay. Welcome.
So he was a statistician. I mean, he was a lot of things, but he was heavily influenced by Gregor Mendel.
I don't know him either.
You don't know Greg? You've learned Gregor Mendel.
Okay.
He had the pea plants in biology.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
He is the one who predicted like the colors of peas. There's like a formula for it.
Okay.
You learned this.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But yeah, this dizzy bitch thought that you could cultivate humans like peas.
I mean, why not?
But at the time, geneticists were still struggling to understand the variation in fruit fly eye color. They didn't have a word for mutation yet.
Okay.
And mutation is rampant in every species. But he thought that.
Of course.
Because Mendel could predict it. Like, he could predict something as complex as human intelligence.
Like, literally, you're taking, like, the most simple life form and trying to
Fuck
scale up.
Peas to humans?
Yeah, that's a leap for sure.
A little bit, yeah. So the British take on eugenics was all about selective breeding for positive traits. It was very optimistic, very naive. And I guess the American version started out similar. It was all about healthy children and a strong society. It was something everyone could get behind. It was a very, like, a progressive, like, I'm for healthy children and a stronger society.
Of course. And, like, in theory, that sounds great. But in reality, you're saying, like, some people should breed and some people should not. And that's fucked.
Exactly. It was the flip side, what you just described, that made it very problematic. In the American version, quickly focused on eliminating negative traits instead of promoting positive traits.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
They saw genes as this, like, hidden menace.
Sure.
Who hurt us?
We hurt ourselves.
True. Ding, ding, ding. That is the correct answer. So the first state to make eugenics law was Indiana in 1907.
A eugenics law?
Law.
Go on.
So when I saw this, I was so happy it wasn't Ohio. Right, yeah. That was like, yeah. I'm like, it's one state off, but like, we did it, you guys.
It wasn't us.
Huzzah! After this law in 1907, a wave of similar laws followed in 30-plus states, most notably California. California had the biggest, most organized program. You remember that I was gonna focus originally, my scandal was gonna be California.
Yes, yeah.
Because that's where most of it happened, but it is so dark.
Wow.
But yeah, California did a lot of testicular transplants, and I'm just gonna leave it at that.
Transplants.
I'm gonna leave it at that, but I will put all the information.
So weird that how like this cocktail.
Yeah, and I'm like, wait, what? We're on the same wavelength.
I feel like every episode they get stronger and stronger. Like we're just like mind melds.
Yeah,
like,
we're just gonna merge into one person at the end. Yeah, I couldn't believe this cocktail. I'm like, wow. And you're just like, oh, it's after a mad scientist. I'm like, oh, God, stop it. This is too much for me.
Wow.
I'm so excited. So California did some really fucked up shit. So much so that the Germans turned to California for advice in perfecting and scaling their own efforts. I'm not going to talk about them, but I will put all the information that I found in the show notes for listeners who want nightmares.
Fun. It is October. So
yeah, it is.
Tis the season for nightmares.
But I couldn't talk about it. It was too much. So eugenics was not just the law. It was a wildly popular social movement in the 20s and 30s. During this time, societies were founded. Aryan clubs were founded. We were just talking about Aryan clubs.
That's so bizarre. Yeah, my family is mostly German. And both sides of my family, I've heard my grandparents talk about belonging to the Aryan club.
Yeah, it was a thing.
Good times.
During this time, members of these Aryan clubs and eugenic societies, they competed in these like fitter family and better baby contests. White people entered themselves into genetic fitness contests where they were at state fairs, where they were measured like livestock.
Jesus
Christ. It's amazing. There's this really, really good documentary I got a lot of my information from on PBS called The Eugenics Crusade. It is incredible. Everyone needs to watch it. There's so many unintentionally hilarious newsreels from that time of just like people on scales, like little children, like smiles, like, hee, measure me.
Wow.
Yeah. So eugenics was a huge part of American culture for 50 plus years.
50 years. Wow.
Yeah. Okay. Plus years.
Yeah.
I mentioned that there were popular trash books like that, Madison Grant's book that mm-hmm. Hitler was talking about. There were also trash movies.
Okay.
You love problematic movies. Have you heard of The Black Stork, 1917?
Mm-mm. Black Stork?
The Black Stork.
No.
It was re-released 10 years later under the title, Are You Fit to Marry?
Mm-mm.
You've never heard of this?
Fit to Marry?
Correct.
Oh, no.
Yeah. These horrifying movies were based on a true story of John Bollinger.
Oh.
Oh, you know about John?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. A little bit.
So the movie was about this heroic doctor that allowed little infant Johnny to die slowly of syphilis to spare society one more outcast.
Oh, my God.
The first time it was released, like, in the 30s, they supposedly burned all the copies of it because they were just like, we don't need this out there. But then apparently there are still a few copies of, like, the re-release.
Weird.
Are You Fit to Marry?
It's weird to me that they even were self-aware enough to be like, this is bad.
Yeah.
'Cause there were plenty of other movies that were like horrific that were being screened in the White House.
Which well, I think it was so bad.
Yeah.
I think the fact that it involved a baby that was allowed to die slowly. That's why.
Yeah, that's why. That's why.
I mean, there are levels of darkness. Aren't you happy you have this cocktail? So at first, sterilization efforts focused on sick or disabled people.
Sick people.
Yeah. I.e. the most vulnerable people in society.
Yeah.
Middle fingers up to that. Like, fuck you. But later grew into include people whose only crime was poverty. I mean, disability and poverty are linked, definitely, and it's by design.
Yeah.
Definitely not an accident. But there were all kinds of categories of people who were deemed to be unfit.
Mm-hmm.
So many that it was really in the eyes of the beholder. And this is where the movement meets Miss Carrie Bell. A poor teen born in Charlottesville, a place where only good things happen.
North Kakalaki.
Scandal over.
Stephanie just throws her paper on the ground and storms off.
For shame. So in her landmark case, the state of Virginia wanted to sterilize her for feeble-mindedness. Their evidence was she was a poor pregnant teen. Case closed.
Was she,
what?
I was going to say, was she actually like, well, quote, feeble-minded? Like,
we'll get there.
Not that that would make it okay anyways, but
so
like,
I have, it's good that you asked this because I'm actually stopping here to just define feeble-minded.
Okay, thank you.
It meant low intelligence, but it was this like mania in the U.S.
Yeah.
It was really a progressive idea. It was what the liberals were really pushing.
Really?
They felt the country was being overrun by this tide of feeble-mindedness, that all these low intelligence people were having children more quickly. Feeble-minded was his word to define large categories of people that were just despised in some way. Drinking, gambling, not being married, not being rich made you feeble.
Not being married is code for homosexual.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. That was in there as well. This was big.
Yeah.
Again, I said it lasted 50 plus years. Non-straight people were in this as well.
I mean, this is right out of the handbook of, I guess it's out of our handbook.
Our handbook. Correct. Yeah. Our handbook. But yes. We were doing that this here before they were doing that there.
Wow.
Yes. Okay. Pulling non-married, quote unquote, people and locking them away and then sterilizing them. Jeez. So this was a very broad category and it got really slippery when used to describe women. Are you shocked? Women who are interested in sex, like it's pleasurable or something.
Burn her.
Yeah. They were feeble.
Yeah.
Of course they were feeble. So it was a big ass category by design. It was almost impossible. They had these feeble-mindedness hearings. It was almost impossible to prove that you weren't feeble-minded.
How do you?
You can't.
Jesus.
Yes. So back to Carrie. The facts, and facts are in air quotes, the facts of her case as told by Dr. Bell, the superintendent of Virginia's colony for epileptics and feeble-minded, he's the Bell in Buck v. Bell.
Wow. Okay.
His story, and it is a story, air quotes around that, went like this. Carrie's mother, Emma, a, quote, feeble-minded woman, was sent to the colony in 1920. As a result, Carrie was placed into foster care. Because when you're feeble, you can't care for children. So your children are taken away.
Okay.
There had been no issues until Carrie was a teen. This is when she became rebellious and promiscuous. She had the audacity to grow breasts. The evidence was her pregnancy at 17. So she was abandoned by her foster parents and sent to the same colony as her mother, where she was examined by a judge and two doctors, all men, who determined she was...
For feeble-minded people in the U.S.?
Oh, colonies everywhere, yes.
Jesus fucking Christ, okay.
Feeble-minded and epileptics.
Uh-huh. Epileptics, okay, great.
Exactly. Your
Jesus
face.
Christ.
Okay. This panel determined that she was, wait for it, feeble-minded.
No.
Yes.
You don't say.
But also, her newborn daughter, Vivian, was too.
I can't.
Yeah. So Carrie, according to the state of Virginia, was a perfect candidate for sterilization. She was a woman of supposed low intelligence from a poor family who, according to a BS eugenics panel, was, get this, oversexed and excessively fertile.
Excessively fertile.
This eugenics panel said this.
Go on. I can't.
So this panel was acting on newly minted sterilization law that went into place in 1924 in Virginia. It allowed for any incarcerated person deemed, quote, defective to be sterilized involuntarily by the state.
The fuck?
I'm taking another sip.
You
yes.
know that, yeah, please do. You know that... It's on AIM, that like sound of the door closing went like so-and-so left the room. That's me right now. I'm like, I'm gone.
Your spirit has left.
Yeah, Tux's spirit has left the room.
So Virginia dressed this shit eugenics law, this bill in the language that made it seem like they were doing these human beings a favor by taking away their autonomy. I have some really delicious quotes.
So they should write thank you letters.
Yes, yes. They're so lucky, you know, just sure. to have their sex organs cut out of their body. I'm jealous, actually. No, I'm not. I'll be honest. Okay, so whereas the Commonwealth has in custodial care and is supporting in various state institutions many defective persons who, if now discharged or paroled, would likely become, by the propagation of their kind, a menace to society, but who, if incapable of procreating, might properly and safely be discharged or paroled and become self-supporting with the benefit to both themselves and to society.
I've left the room. I don't even know. Jesus.
I feel like I've just kicked you in the dick with my words.
Yes.
The law goes on to say that basically the superintendent of any state facility can authorize surgeons to sterilize any patient confined to an institution afflicted with, quote, hereditary forms of insanity, idiocy, imbecility, feeble-mindedness, and epilepsy. Only one of these is real, but still, fuck you.
Exactly.
Seriously, also still, fuck you. You can't, yeah, I mean, you can.
They did.
So there was a BS, like, review panel, and they the patient would be given 30 days notice that their fallopian tubes would be cut from their bodies. How kind.
30 days, like to flee? Like
they're already in state custody. So, yeah.
Jesus.
So why even give them notice?
Literally. That's even worse. That yeah. you're like counting down the days. Like yeah. I'm about to get fucking...
Yeah. So at the colony, this procedure was so routine, according to Dr. Bell, and this is in his own hand. He wrote, men on Tuesdays, women on Thursdays.
Good.
So the truth of the matter was Carrie was not feeble-minded. She was the first of three kids. We really don't know much about her mother, Emma Bell, except that she was poor and she was married to some man who abandoned her pretty quickly into her marriage. And because of this, because she was an unmarried woman with children, she was committed to the state colony after being accused of immorality, prostitution, and...
feeble-mindedness.
Thank you.
Ding, 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 ding.
Tim, add some Jamaican air horns.
Prostitution, huh? Okay.
Yeah, because that's how she got her children.
Sure.
Clearly. But yeah, in reality, she was just a poor single mother who had children from two different men. So when her mother was committed to the colony, the state basically said that she was unfit to be a mother. So Carrie was sent to a foster family. She was sent to Alice and John Dobbs. They sent her to public school, and according to her teachers, she was an average student.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't like...
She wasn't feeble-minded?
If that was a thing, no. She was not that. Regardless of the fact that she did okay in school, not good, not terrible, just like she was a normal student, when she was in the sixth grade, the Dobbs family removed her from school to help with the housework.
Ah.
I kind of wanted a servant, it seemed like.
Sure.
While working in their home, Carrie was raped by Alice Dobbs's nephew.
Oh, okay.
Months later, when I think she probably started to show, the Dobbses very conveniently had her committed to the colony on the ground of...
Feeble-mindedness. Ooh, yeah.
So good. There she gave birth to her daughter, Vivian, since she had been declared mentally, air quotes, unfit to raise her child... The Dobbses adopted her baby.
Are you fucking kidding me? Because it was their family.
Yeah. Those motherfuckers. Yes. So when I first found this scandal and I read all the details, I'm just like confused. Like, who the fuck brought this case to the Supreme Court on Carrie's behalf? Like, no one gave half a shart about her.
Yeah.
The whole thing was a sham. No one brought it in her behalf. Like, the state brought it to test their Virginia law, basically.
Wow.
So the whole lower court trial was a sham. The Virginia eugenics law, even though it had no challenges in the state, when other states tried to replicate the law, it failed.
Okay.
So they wanted to bring it in front of the Supreme Court to just affirm in the highest court of the land.
So that other states could do it,
correct,
too. How do you bring a case to a higher court if no one's trying it in a lower court? Like, if
no, they're trying it.
Who's the defendant and who's the plaintiff? Like,
the plaintiff is Carrie, and she had a lawyer, but her lawyer was working for the state. colluding with the state. So Virginia's medical elite hand-selected Carrie Buck because according to them, was a second-generation feeble-minded person who had just given birth to a third generation. Are you okay?
Yeah. I mean...
I keep looking over at you and you're just...
trying to like... This is not how
you're trying to make sense out of nonsense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the state manufactured evidence to support this claim. Her lawyer, instead of defending her... conspired with the state, like was paid by the state.
Jesus Christ. I have said that so many times.
I know. So what did the Supreme Court do? You know, the body that's supposed to protect the most marginalized, what did they do?
I don't even want to know. Because I know they did the wrong thing.
They did the opposite of what they should have done. At first, I really gave them the benefit of the doubt because all of what they heard was lies.
Yeah.
Like most of what they heard was just not true. Get this, the state allowed several people who never actually met Carrie to testify against her.
In what capacity?
So there were teachers, multiple teachers, who testified about the behavior and aptitude of her relatives. Yeah, what does my cousin and them's grade have to do with me? But their whole thing was like, it's genetic. So if her cousins were bad at school, therefore she's bad at school.
And so her cousins are all feeble-minded too?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes, exactly. They had some elitist asshole named Harry Laughlin, who never met Carrie. This man is actually a scandal in himself. He's one of the reasons that eugenics became so popular in the U.S.
Wow. Okay.
I'm not even going to talk about him because I might talk about him in the mini.
Okay.
He never met Carrie. He wrote in saying... Carrie Buck and her family were part of the shiftless, ignorant, worthless class of antisocial whites of the South, whose feeble-mindedness is caused by the inheritance of degenerate qualities.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So times. Anyone who was like pro-eugenics would be like, yeah, Carrie ain't shit.
Yeah, I read about her in the newspaper. Yeah. She sucks. Fuck her.
So... in digging deeper into this particular Supreme Court, I'm not 100% sure, had they heard the truth, that they would have done anything differently.
Okay.
They were not great. It would be hard to imagine a less sympathetic, more elitist group of people.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. So for starters, the Chief Justice and ex-president, William Howard Taft, the dude who was supposed to like set the tone for the court, had direct ties to the eugenics movement.
That's not a conflict of interest.
No, not at all. Not at all. If that wasn't bad enough, the four conservative justices on the court at the time, they were nicknamed the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
Yeah.
Because they were just, you know, so humane and reasonable. To top it all off, and this is actually my favorite antidote about this court, and there are many. This whole court is really, really bad. Like, really, really bad. There's no formal portrait of this Supreme Court because... one of the justices refused to sit next to Louis Brandeis, the first Jewish member, first Jewish justice. So there's just no picture of them because they're just like, no, we don't accept him.
Let me reattach my jaw. Jesus.
So the court, they ruled 8-1. Their decision said that Virginia's compulsory sterilization of the unfit, which included the intellectually disabled, did not violate the 14th Amendment because it was for the protection and health of the state. Mm-hmm. For those who don't know, the 14th Amendment was it was part of the Reconstruction Amendments. It's basically like due process or equal protection. Ha ha ha.
Yeah.
Equal protection of the law. Like, that's a thing. Yeah, they're saying that it didn't violate it. So this garbage ruling emboldened 30 plus other states to adopt their own laws, leading to the sterilization of hundreds of thousands of people. Some weren't even notified. So Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., he was supposedly this progressive beacon on this really dark court. He wrote the majority opinion. Trash. He used a single case to co-sign the state's compulsory sterilization of Carrie. The case that he used was Jacobson versus Massachusetts, which no one has heard of, but it allowed for involuntary vaccination of smallpox. Because at the time, smallpox was this really big thing. In Massachusetts, was like, everyone needs to have...
No, I'm all for a compulsory vaccination of smallpox. But how does that have anything to do with...
Oh, it doesn't. And thank you for saying that. Because when I read this, I'm like, it's not the same at all. So this is what he wrote. Oh, man, this is... Maybe take a sip.
Yeah, I mean, another one?
Carrie Buck, he wrote, is a feeble-minded white woman. She is the daughter of a feeble-minded mother in the same institution and the mother of an illegitimate feeble-minded child. We have seen more than once that the public welfare may call upon the best citizens for their lives. It would be strange if it could not call upon those who already sap the strength of the state for these lesser sacrifices, often not felt to be such by those concerned. To prevent our being swamped with incompetence, it is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. The principle that sustains compulsory vaccination is broad enough to cover cutting the fallopian tubes. Three generations of imbeciles are enough.
For fuck's sake, I don't even know what to say.
It's so profoundly inhumane and sinister.
Mm-hmm. What did the other justices that were against it?
So it was 8-1, and I'm actually...
One.
Yes. So Pierce Butler, he was the one lone Catholic on the court at the time. He voted against. But he didn't write a dissent.
Oh.
So some people say that he was so upset that it was like a silent protest because it was really uncharacteristic not to write a dissent.
Yeah.
Especially if something's 8-1. Other people were saying that he was trying to like go along to get along because he was part of this really shitty court and he didn't want his like ain't shit coworkers to be mad at him.
Yeah.
So okay. He voted against, but he didn't say why.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Maybe he voted to appease the Catholic Church because at the time there was this really big like anti-Catholic. It was the 20s.
Yeah.
They felt like Catholics were Protestants, like rich white Protestants felt like Catholics were having too many babies.
Sure.
So I don't know. I feel like he should have wrote something.
He
like,
should have. Absolutely.
Even if it's like, fuck all y'all. Like, no, draw a picture of your dick. Like, say. Do something. You know, let them know that this is not okay. Because it's so... Not okay is not the right word. I need something way stronger. It's disgusting, is what it is. Holmes, who again is supposed to be this like... Even today, he's praised as being this progressive thinker.
Mm-hmm.
In constitutional law, like, people cite him all the time. He's just... People love him. But again, it's people who don't learn about this case. Like, even lawyers love him.
Yeah.
He would later describe Buck v. Bell as, quote, an assignment that gave me pleasure.
Gross.
Yeah, so he would say that this assignment gave him pleasure. And he referred to people who were not down with the way that he ruled as the thick-fingered clowns we call people.
Trump voters? I'm sorry. I shouldn't. I mean, I should, but I shouldn't.
You did.
Yes, I did.
So a lot of my information for this scandal came from excerpts from a book by Adam Cohen called Imbeciles. He is a New York Times, the failing New York Times. He's a columnist there. So he said, eugenics was a movement of people who believed themselves to be inherently superior. Holmes never questioned the version of Carrie Buck's life provided by the Virginia authorities because it was exactly what he wanted to hear.
Yeah.
And he said that people with wealth and influence equated human worth with the qualities that they themselves possessed, or at least they thought they possessed. So, like, anyone beneath them is, like, not on their level, basically.
Yeah.
Like, they know better because they're, like, the good people. So, there isn't a ton of information about Carrie post-ruling. What little I learned was really tragic.
Yeah.
Because she's a woman of that era, like, people don't really keep tabs on people like that. So she was discharged soon after being sterilized against her will. Her daughter, Vivian, who was raised by the Dobbses, she died really young.
Oh.
She died at 8 of the measles. And I just feel like she probably wasn't really cared for.
Yeah.
Because clearly Carrie was not cared for in their home. Carrie found out after the fact 2 weeks later.
Mm.
Her mom also died really young, and she found out after the funeral when she arrived at the colony for a visit. So she
went to visit her mom, and she was dead, and no one had told her?
Correct. No one told her about her child as well. Yeah. Could you imagine? Like, it's like people back then didn't realize that people were people.
I mean, people like,
today. People don't know today. You're right. You're right. But it's like your mother has died and no one has told you.
That's so fucked up.
So it's beyond. So she was married twice. Her second marriage was only after her first husband died. So she wasn't promiscuous. She wasn't this, like, rebellious woman.
Yeah.
She was in long-term committed relationships.
And she was raped. Like, what? Yeah. How does... That it's never... clearly her fault that because she was oversexed.
Yes. Yes. It's such... Oversexed. And excessively fertile. Like,
excessively fertile means that her body didn't block that whole thing.
Oh, yeah. Now my spirit is left.
Yeah.
Her body was in birth control.
Yeah. Ugh.
I hate everything. So she read the newspaper daily. She loved the crossword puzzle. She never had much money because she was like a poor woman and she worked low wage jobs, which was, you know, characteristic of the time. But people who knew her never saw any mental deficiencies.
Because there wasn't one.
Because there wasn't one.
But even if there was...
Yeah, thank you.
This is still unacceptable. Exactly.
Yeah, even if there was, this is not okay at all. In 1980, reporters asked her what she thought about the Supreme Court case that bore her name. No one had asked her until...
Ever?
Until 1980. She told reporters that her greatest regret was being unable to have more children.
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
Because her kid was taken away from her and died so young.
Yeah.
She said that she hadn't fully understood the nature of the procedure until several years later.
Sure, of course.
And that was really common. I'm not going to get into this, but like so many women specifically were sterilized without their consent.
Yeah.
But like without their knowledge.
Having explained to them what was happening.
They would go in for something and they would leave sterilized. It became really popular in the South. It was called the Mississippi appendectomy.
Jesus
that you
Christ.
Would go in for anything. Like, you go in for your tonsils and they would sterilize you if you were a black poor woman in the South.
Yeah.
She That's said, horrific. They done me wrong. They done us all wrong. And 3 years after this interview, she died.
Yeah.
She would get a BS apology from the state of Virginia posthumously on the 75th anniversary.
Nice.
Yeah, right? Oh, lucky her. They apologized. On the 75th anniversary of the decision, the governor called it a shameful effort, one in which the state government should have never been involved, but they were involved. So in 1935, a decade after Virginia's eugenics laws, the practice was like going full speed, like not as big as California, because California was insane, but there were a number of Virginia doctors complaining that, quote, "The Germans were beating us at our own game" in 1938. Yes.
1938. Yeah, of course.
So it's not surprising that Buck v. Vell was decided in the roaring 20s because it was a decade that was even more politically charged than today.
Mm-hmm.
Prohibition was happening. Creationists were battling Darwinists. The KKK was at its peak.
Mm-hmm.
There was so much like anti-Catholic and anti-Jewish sentiment. In Washington, Congress was writing the most restrictive immigration laws in our nation's history. They were writing these laws to, quote, "protect the country from foreign contamination." An Alabama senator at the time said, "We are coming to a pitiful pass in this great country when it is unpopular to speak the English language, the American language." Guess what language he was talking about?
The American language?
Yes, that's what he said.
Clearly he's talking about Swahili.
He was talking about Yiddish.
Yiddish?
Yes. So 40 to 50% of people from Eastern Europe, Jewish people from Eastern Europe, were labeled feeble-minded at Ellis Island. Almost 50%. We were like Oprah when it came to feeble-mindedness. We were just giving it out like cars. Like, you get feeble-minded. You're feeble-minded.
Oh my God.
Yes. Almost 50% of Jewish people from Eastern Europe were feeble-minded. We have the receipts. Because they wrote that shit down. So, are you okay? I'm going to take another sip.
Please.
Yes, more drunk, please. So, eugenics was this really kind of like sexy movement because there was this like thin veneer of science.
Mm-hmm.
It gave justification to this like us v them mindset. It was this simple belief that genes were the reason for a person's success. And that was so, so seductive because it absolved society and people.
Yeah, and it's science. Yeah. So
it's science.
You can't dispute it.
It's next just, question?
It's just science, yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense if you don't think about it. So it was super disturbing to learn how the state of Virginia basically conspired to deprive a poor, uneducated, but perfectly intelligent young woman of her liberty, her dignity, her bodily integrity, and her right to choose whether or not to have a child.
Yeah.
And this was a teen who only had a child because she was raped, not because she was passed down some feeble-minded gene. It's so fucked up that the Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, co-signed this. 8-1
It's insane.
So what happened to Carrie Buck in 1927 is still relevant today, because guess when this decision was like stricken down or overturned? And this is a leading question.
Oh, God.
Guess when?
I want it to be in the 40s, but I know it's in, I'm going to guess, the 70s.
I'm so glad that you're sitting down. It's never been overturned. It's still being used. Still being used today. It was cited as Roe v. Wade to show that certain people by law don't have unlimited right to do what they want with their bodies. It was the precursor to modern abortion bills. It's still used for incarcerated people. They're still being sterilized. So it was, yeah. Are you okay?
I will never be able to fully reattach my jaw. Yeah. Oh my.
Still on the books.
Fucking
still
Lord.
Being used. It was used as late as 2015, I believe. I'm going to drop an article in the show notes.
Jeez.
Yeah. So sterilization was for the most despised people, criminals, and people that were most afraid of, i.e. the mentally ill. Again, two middle fingers up for that. And the one thing that these two groups, like people who are caught up in the criminal justice system and the mentally ill, is that they're often poor.
Yeah.
It's like what binds them.
Sure.
This whole decision exposes this like dark but like foundational current that America is, quote, special and must take steps to ensure that it's not degraded by outsiders or undesirable elements from within. It's so fucked up. Eugenics billed itself as being about improving genetic quality, but it was really about preserving the status quo.
Yeah.
It was a fear response, fear of immigration, fear of disease, fear of social unrest. And we're living through a very similar time now, which is why this scandal popped out at me. In May 1920, a famous eugenicist named Charles Davenport asks, "Can we build a wall high enough around the country so as to keep out these cheaper races?"
Cheaper?
So yeah, we need to learn about history so we stop repeating at the end.
That's, oh God.
I'm sorry.
I feel like just when you thought that we've hit rock bottom.
Exactly.
We find out that there's an entire extra layer.
Oh yeah.
Beneath.
And that layer is thick.
Oh my.
It lasts 50 years.
God. Holy shit. I'm not going to be able to speak or read for the next episode or the next story, but Jesus Christ. Let's go make more drinks.
Yes.
This is Brandon from Peculiar Picture Show, the podcast that talks about movies, maladies, and mental health.
And this is Maria, also from that podcast.
So we were wondering, do you like movies? Do you like mental health?
Oh boy, do I ever, Brandon.
Well then, I've got a podcast for you. Peculiar Picture Show is the podcast for you because it is about movies and mental health.
That's right. We use movies to talk about mental health issues like borderline personality disorder, social issues like systemic racism, and other things.
Like how bad Shakespeare in Love was.
Yeah, sometimes we just talk about how bad the movie is.
And we really talked about that one. But sometimes we have games. Maria used to be a teacher, and so she loves to quiz people.
I really do.
So check us out online at peculiarpicture.show. That's our website, and you can stream all episodes there.
Or you can find us on any major podcast channel.
Well, I'm going to tell another tale of...
Is it scary like mine?
It's Halloween appropriate, but it's also... oddly tied to a tale of woman's tragedy, and it's fucked up. Excuse me while I take yet another sip of this delicious monkey gland.
The name is so much. But it's delicious. It really is
good.
But
I really think it would
I would
be...
order this if I was not so self-conscious about the whole name. What
the name is, yeah. The absinthe is what really sets it apart.
It's delicious.
Yeah. So, the White House is reportedly haunted. And I'm not just talking like regular haunted. I'm talking real, real haunted.
What is regular haunted, though?
But like a regular house. Just somebody's house. Like, oh, I saw one ghost.
Okay.
I'm talking like there are several ghosts.
Yeah.
There are several many ghosts at the White House.
I have seen this. I did not look into it. Yeah. But yes.
Yeah.
Many, many people were saying that they saw different people and things. Yeah,
because the White House is haunted by famous people.
Yes.
Ooh.
Ooh. Presidential hauntings.
Yes. People have reported that they have seen Abigail Adams doing laundry in the East Room. Apparently her ghost is stuck doing laundry for eternity.
That's sexist.
I know. Apparently, she actually did used to do laundry in the White House back when it was, like, first, like, new and the first lady still had to do laundry
still on her sexist. Own.
Yeah. Andrew Jackson has been seen stomping through the hallways and swearing in the White House.
Sounds like him.
In fact, Andrew Jackson's old bedroom is considered one of the most haunted rooms in the White House.
His bedroom is, like, whose bedroom now?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I mean, every room is painted gold now, so I don't know. Would you like to take a guess at who the most frequently reported
Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln? People, ding, 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 ding.
Of course. Pew, pew, pew. Of course. He's a saint. Yes. So he's godly, etc.
Abraham Lincoln. Calvin Coolidge's wife, Grace, was the first person to ever report seeing Abraham Lincoln's ghost in the White House. She said that she saw him standing and looking out of a window in the Oval Office. Eleanor Roosevelt used to use the Lincoln bedroom as her private study when she was in the White House and said that she could feel his presence when she worked there late at night.
Hmm.
Lady Bird Johnson said that she felt Lincoln's presence one night when she stayed up late to watch a TV program about his death.
So wait, what is feeling one's presence?
Even? I mean...
You don't see them, but you feel them?
Yawn.
Yeah.
You didn't see a ghost. I don't want to hear about it.
Yeah.
But you know who did see a ghost is Winston Churchill.
Okay.
Winston Churchill said that one night while he was getting out of the bath, standing completely nude, ooh, other than a cigar in his mouth, he saw Lincoln sitting by the fireplace in his room.
He would.
Yeah. And Queen Wilhelmina of the Netherlands once visited the White House, and she said that she heard a knock on her bedroom door late one night, and she reportedly fainted cold to the floor when she opened the door to find Abraham Lincoln standing there in his top hat.
No clothes?
I don't know if she was clothed or not.
I'm like, why does she faint? Because it's like you're seeing Lincoln's dick? Well, she Lincoln's saw a ghost. Dick? Oh, yeah, because he's dead. Yes. Okay.
He dead.
I like that I'm a prevert.
Yeah. You, such a prevert.
It's the stage before you get to pervert. You have to work your way up, and I'm getting there, you guys.
Yeah. But so there has been this like connection between Lincoln and ghosts in the White House, though, since before he was even actually dead.
Wow.
There was a connection between ghosts and Lincoln during the Civil War because the Civil War changed the way Americans not only understood death and dying, but also the way they mourned.
What do you mean?
Because the Civil War, people were dying so fast and people who were back home didn't know how to handle it. Because I'll get into this a little bit further. But for now, I would like to propose a toast.
Yes.
I'd like to propose a toast to normalizing mourning
and grieving. Yes.
And encouraging people to show emotion and cry.
We need this. Absolutely. Yes. I will drink to this every day. And that's,
cheers.
That's my excuse for alcoholism.
I would also like to toast to mental health care as well.
Absolutely.
So, during the Civil War, men were dying by the thousands on these faraway battlefields, hundreds and hundreds of miles from home. And, you know, we didn't have cars, we didn't have ambulances, we didn't have motor vehicles to carry bodies and stuff. So a lot of times the bodies were just left where they fell. And there would just be these like mass graves. People would just be, they would just lump soil over them. And there were so many deaths. We talked about this a little bit in the last episode.
You talked about this in the last episode about how the daughters of of the Confederacy, like that was their, was why they became a thing. Is that they wanted to give individual like Christian burials to soldiers.
Yeah. But a lot of times that wasn't even possible because there was very little information about where battles were being fought, where individual men were stationed and where they were fighting. For families either in the North or the South, they didn't know where their...
Because they were moving.
Yeah, they were moving around and they didn't know. And so mothers were mourning the losses of their fallen sons. Wives were being widowed. Children were being orphaned. And information about when or where or how or even if their loved ones were dying was really hard to come by and often inaccurate.
Yeah.
And with so much unknown, it was difficult to have a proper funeral because they often didn't have a body. And without a funeral, people just didn't understand how they were supposed to grieve because there was a chance that this person was still alive
lost. Yeah. Lost. Yeah.
Or, I mean, there were so many different
scenarios. Anything was possible.
Exactly. Yeah. They just had no idea. This person could have died in any number of ways, or they might even still be alive. So to mourn them felt confusing. Many people during the Civil War turned to spiritualism, which is basically the idea that it is possible to communicate with the dead as sort of a way to help them answer questions about their missing loved ones and hopefully to help them get closure for somebody that they thought probably had died or maybe even definitely had died, but they just didn't have any way to understand that death.
Are they using Ouija boards?
Seances.
Okay.
Seances were the most common tool for making contact with the dead at this time.
So it wasn't like Milton Bradley.
No, not quite yet. Yeah.
You're like, no. It's this legitimate thing. I'm like,
I mean, it's not.
It's not. Yeah. You're right. But it's not a board game.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it might as well be. I mean, it was like a magic show, essentially.
Yeah.
A magic show for grieving widows.
I mean, I shouldn't be making light of grieving widows.
So the ideas and practices of spiritualism were around well before the Civil War.
Oh, absolutely.
Had been around for forever.
Yeah, since the dawn of time.
But the war really specifically helped those ideas spread, and the war made it really popular. Spiritualism blew up because of the Civil War. And by 1897, it said that spiritualism had more than 8 million believers, mostly from the upper and middle classes, both in America, but also in Europe. The idea spread because it was so common in America in the upper class, and the upper class was able to travel.
Yes.
So Europe sort of adopted the same belief system at the same time, around the same time. Hmm. And I think that this is sort of tangential, but I think that the reason so many horror movies focus on Victorian ghosts or like Victorian houses or whatever, and ghosts in Victorian houses, is because the Victorian era was the era that spiritualism really first...
Where everything was spooky.
Yeah. That was the first time that it was really commonly accepted and people were having, like regular people were having seances.
Yeah.
And conjuring ghosts into their
having
homes.
Having experiences with ghosts.
Yeah.
But people who were not at the White House.
Well, so Mary Todd Lincoln... got into spiritualism before it was cool.
Ooh, look at her being a hipster. She's like, fuck all y'all. Yeah. I'm over it, actually.
Yeah, I've been into spiritualism.
Back in the day, I was into what you guys are loving right now.
I mean, this was still during the Civil War, but it wasn't until kind of the end that everyone was really like into spiritualism, but she was in it. Like,
spiritualism in what way, though?
Just the idea that it was that you could...
That there were spirits.
And that you could communicate with them.
Like, just anyone could communicate with...
With the help of a medium. Yes.
I love that medium economy was going strong.
Oh, it is 100% all about getting that money.
That sounds like, hey guys, I'm actually a medium. Pay me.
Yeah, no, literally, Venmo literally. Me. I mean, it's basically a magic trick. So if if you could make people believe.
But like a cheap magic trick.
I mean, but they want
like
to believe that.
They want to believe. So
exactly.
They're like, oh, you said spring and his birthday was in May.
Exactly.
Like,
absolutely.
Is that spring?
Yeah. Yeah. So this whole thing started in 1862.
Oh, okay. Early.
During the Civil War, though.
I redact all of my shade.
So it's 1862, and the Lincoln's 11-year-old son, Willie, died. Probably from typhoid.
Wow. Yeah. No, I remember seeing Mary Todd Lincoln's... And also Lincoln, too, got really depressed after their son's death.
I'm going to get into Lincoln first a little bit.
Okay,
so
I'm going to stop.
He was totally, totally overwhelmed, completely overcome with grief.
Of course. Your child was dead.
His son was dead.
Your young child is dead.
Yeah, he was 11 years old. Yeah. But this is actually not their first child who died.
I know.
They had lost another son about a decade earlier who was only like 3 or something.
A baby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Things got so intense with Abe's grieving.
Yeah.
He was like going and asking the priest? I don't know, managers of the graveyard to open Willie's casket so he could like talk to him before he was buried.
Yikes.
Like things were intense. And Mary Todd and her sister, I think it was actually more her sister because Mary Todd was going through some shit too at the time. They were really worried about Lincoln's mental state at the time, but he had his duties as president and the Civil War to kind of pull him out of it and distract him. Mary Todd Lincoln did not have that distraction, and she was not so fortunate. Her seamstress and black friend, Elizabeth Keckley.
Ooh.
Yeah, she's a whole nother story.
Thank
I could
you.
Talk about Elizabeth Keckley.
Okay.
I'm only like this is my only quote and my only time that I'm going to be talking
she's
about her. But
amazing,
she has a whole story too. Yeah.
She has a whole story, but also like what she achieved.
Yes,
is like revolutionary.
Yeah,
yeah. When I learned about her, I'm just like, what?
Yeah, yeah. But so she said, or she wrote, Mrs. Lincoln's grief. Is inconsolable. He was his mother's favorite child.
It's true. I remember in my research, like, she truly went through with her first one, but, like, it was even worse with her second one because it was, I mean, favorite is a weird term, but it was, he
and
was.
And even Abe said that, like, he was
favorite.
The most like Abe, too.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
But so she had also, Mary Todd also lost her mother at a very young age, too.
Oh, I didn't
too.
Know that.
So when Willie died, I mean, she had lost her son, Eddie, 10 years earlier or a decade or so earlier. When Willie died, they were in the White House. She locked herself off in her room and wouldn't come out.
But she eventually came out.
Like, she did. Yeah. She stayed in bed for weeks. But then she did eventually come out. But she was only wearing like traditional sort of Victorian mourning gowns.
Black gowns.
Big black dresses.
Yeah, yes. The veil.
She just had a really hard time containing her grief. And it was at a time when...
Yeah.
Victorian Americans didn't really deal well with emotion.
I don't know if it's... I think they dealt with it appropriately. They mourned.
But people in public, especially upper crusty people, you weren't supposed to show emotion.
Oh, no, that's not
She
true
wasn't
then.
Supposed
okay.
to cry. She
okay.
wasn't supposed to
wow.
publicly grieve.
So I guess maybe it's like an upper class sort of thing.
Absolutely.
Because the lower classes, they grieved. And they grieved
but
for
the lower
a year.
The lower classes were not the ones seeing spiritualists. It was upper and middle classes because they were the ones that basically Victorian, like through the early 1900s.
Hmm.
But so when she finally did kind of come out of it, she would just sort of burst into tears out of nowhere. And it made people very
uncomfortable.
Very uncomfortable.
Yes. Everyone hated her.
No, like, everyone hated her.
And it's like she went through a loss, but everyone like demonized her.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. She kind of started to look towards the church to kind of help her find comfort in Willie's death, but she just couldn't let Willie go. And this is when some friends of hers told her she might not have to. That Willie was still here and was anxious to speak with her. And they knew who could put them in touch together for a small fee, of course.
Of course.
For 3 easy payments of $19.99.
They were doctorbs.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Oh, that's so predatory.
Yeah.
You've already experienced such a loss.
So much
yet
loss
people
in her life.
Are...
But if you give me some money, you'll feel better. Yeah, exactly.
Such fucking predators.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You're like...
Yes.
Yes, and?
What's wrong with that? Yeah.
Go
she's,
on.
She's getting something from it, too. I'm getting
Everyone's
money.
Everyone's getting something.
Yeah, exactly. So... Before you could say boo.
I mean, that is a lot to say all of those boos. Yes.
Uppercase, lowercase, uppercase.
I know. Yeah. It's true. There's an oscillation of the boo.
Yes. So before you could say boo, a bunch of spirit ministers, quote unquote, spirit ministers, were parading through the White House and holding seances in the White House.
Spirit ministers?
They were. They sure
That's what they called themselves?
There's many different names for a kind of a person who holds a seance. There's a lot of, I think seance is like and medium.
I've heard of medium.
Yeah. So in the Red Room of the White House, they would all sit around a table, they would dim the lights, and they would hold hands.
No, no.
Someone would play music to attract the spirits out of the darkness.
What kind of music?
I don't know. I mean, 1862 music.
I need to know what just type sort of music. Soft
string. I'm assuming string music, but I don't know. And all the medium really had to do was make a sound somewhere in the room. They had to kind of throw a sound to convince this grieving woman that their lost loved one was showing their spiritual presence. And Mary Todd Lincoln had to just think, Willie's here.
So any sound.
Any sound. They said, oh, that's Willie. So one night,
no.
Mary Todd's half-sister Emily was staying with them. And one night she went to go speak with her late at night. And she said, he lives. He comes to me every night and stands at the foot of my bed with the same sweet, adorable smile he has always had. He does not always come alone. Little Eddie is sometimes with him. You cannot dream of the comfort this gives me. And Emily was not buying it. She was, however, creeped the fuck out.
Obviously.
She wrote in her diary.
Emily and I, we are the same.
Absolutely, yeah.
Wait, what?
Yeah. So Emily wrote in her diary, it is unnatural and abnormal. It frightens me.
Oh, no.
So records show that Mary Todd Lincoln hosted as many as 8 seances in the White House and had even more, many more, at their family home just outside the city. And then the fucking lips started chattering in Washington. Everyone had something to say. The gossip mill in Washington got going, and everyone was talking about how Mary Todd Lincoln was going to seances and blah, 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 blah. Abe kind of started to worry a little bit about her.
Yes.
And when she told him that she wanted to visit these famous mediums called the Witches of Georgetown, it was these two women called the Witches of Georgetown, he said, you know what? I'll come with you.
Oh.
I mean, first of all, he wanted to keep an eye on his wife.
Obviously, yes.
But also, it was a magic show. It was smoke and mirrors. And Abraham Lincoln knew it. He did not believe in ghosts, but I think he had probably heard, because everyone was talking about these women, the Witches of Georgetown. He had heard that one of the two, I think it was a mother-daughter situation, one of them was supposed to be able to levitate pianos.
Stop it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he's like, okay, let me go see this, because they're putting on a show. So he's like, this is going to be lit.
Like, is this going to be lit?
Yeah. I'm going. I'm going to see this. And I can keep on my wife on my wife at the same time, you know?
Well.
But she wasn't just seeing the Witches of Georgetown. She was seeing a lot of different mediums, including another well-known medium, a mustachioed Englishman named Charles Colchester. He went by Duke Colchester.
Stop this.
He claimed to be illegitimate son of a duke.
Nope. I don't know the story, but also this I know that it's a lie.
Yeah. He also claimed to have psychic abilities.
Okay, of course. Why not?
Supposedly he could read sealed letters. He could call out the names of visitors, deceased friends and loved ones.
But how did he prove?
If you wanted to believe it, you believed it.
Stop
yeah.
being stupid. I'm like,
he could cause apparitions to appear in the room and produce words on his forearm in blood red letters.
That's so specific.
But also so predatory, yeah.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
So a Cincinnati newspaper reported, Colchester is regarded as the leader of spiritualism in America. And as a consequence, his votaries, believers, and visitors are counted in the hundreds.
Oh, God.
But Colchester was also known by his skeptics as a con man who employed sleight of hand in darkened rooms to line his pockets at the expense of these grieving, vulnerable women Abraham Lincoln's friend, he had this journalist friend, Noah Brooks, who wrote at the time, "The poor lady at that time was well nigh distraught with the grief at the death of her son Willie. By playing on her motherly sorrows, Colchester actually succeeded in inducing Mrs. Lincoln to receive him in the family residence, where, in a darkened room, he pretended to produce messages from the dead boy by means of scratches on the wainscoting and taps on the walls and furniture." Colchester, not only did he find ways to make these noises in the room with scratching on the wainscoting and stuff, Brooks later found out, somehow, that he wore a specially designed electrical noisemaker. It was just something that would make a noise somewhere in the room so that he could be like, "That's Willie. Oh, that's Willie." And it would be strapped to his arm, kind of under his shirt, so you couldn't see it. Here's the thing. Colchester actually really did love spirits. He really did. He loved...
I believe that you can love spirits, even no, but though they're not real.
He loved alcoholic spirits.
Oh, wait. I mean, so you're saying we are the same.
Yes. Yeah. No, Colchester just loved spirits. The man was a fucking drunk. He would often spend everything that he made at a reading in one night at the bar.
No.
The same night.
Oh, okay.
If you got him drunk enough, he would even sometimes admit, quote, "He often cheated the fools as he could easily do it." Wow. In fact, he was such a regular on the Washington social scene.
What a piece of shit.
He was going out so frequently that he actually met a drinking buddy and became really close with this drinking buddy that you probably heard of this guy.
Oh.
He was a famous aspiring actor, mm-hmm. John Wilkes Booth.
Know. Oh, stop it. Stop it. No. Oh, God. Oh, no.
They were always together at the bar out at
night.
Oh,
no. I'm not here. This is not real.
Booth got into spiritualism in 1863 after his sister-in-law died because his brother, his, you know, sister-in-law's wife, was going to a bunch of seances and Booth was going with him. And he was kind of buying the seances more than his brother even was. Hmm. And that's when he really got into spiritualism. So when he met a famous medium, Colchester, out on the social scene in Washington... He was like, "Woo, I met this guy, and it's great, and I love it." And the best part was that Colchester claimed to be able to tell the future, and Booth was thinking about trying to kidnap the president of the United States.
Yes.
We do not know what Colchester knew about Booth's plan, or what he knew or what he didn't know, but we do know that Booth was not super great at keeping secrets. When Booth's plan changed from kidnapping to murder to assassination, a ton of his friends knew about it.
Really?
He had a bunch of friends that were interviewed after the assassination happened.
They're like,
they all
did
knew
it.
What was happening. I don't think they fully believed him, but they knew he
That's
was
real.
Talking about it. Yeah. But we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit here. So let's backtrack just a little bit. So Mrs. Lincoln was seeing all these mediums, seeing all these psychics, going to these seances more and more frequently. And Abe Lincoln was starting to worry about her.
Of course, yeah.
Especially about Colchester's influence over Mary Todd Lincoln.
Oh, okay.
So he asked his buddy, Noah Brooks, his journalist buddy, to look into Colchester. So Brooks goes to a Colchester seance anonymously, without Mrs. Lincoln there, and you had to pay. So he goes with a friend. He shows up to the seance with a friend. They each pay admission. They go in. Everyone sits around a table. There's a bunch of musical instruments in the center of this table. So everyone holds hands.
Hmm.
The lights are turned off. And it's silent for a moment. And everyone is holding hands, including Colchester. And then suddenly, there's a sound in the dark from one of these musical instruments. And Brooks is with his friend, so his friend lets his hand go, and he reaches towards the center to kind of figure out where the sound is coming from, and he feels somebody's hand in the darkness.
Nope.
So he grabs this hand, and he yells, "Light a match!" to his friend that's sitting next to him. But before his friend could light a match, the drum that was sitting in the center of the table comes crashing down onto his forehead, leaving a small gash on his forehead. But then his friend lights the match, and then eventually the lights are turned on, and everybody in the room sees Noah Brooks, is standing there with a fucking bleeding, bloody forehead, holding on to Colchester, who has the fucking drum and bell in his hands. Colchester was supposed to be holding hands with his guests at the same time, but somehow he tricked them into thinking that he was still holding their hands, let go, grabbed the drum, and was like, boom, 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 boom. And then Brooks caught him. Basically, what Brooks did was call him out for being a fraud in front of everyone in the room. And because Colchester got caught, he smashed him in the head with the drum. But everybody sees what's going on, and then Colchester just slips out of the room before anyone is able to do anything about it. And then, a few days later, Mrs. Lincoln calls Brooks to come see her. And she tells Brooks, Colchester is trying to blackmail me. He's trying to get me to steal a free railroad pass from the War Department.
What?
Because Colchester wants to go to New York. And she's like, I don't know what to do. I can't get this fucking railroad pass from the War Department. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. So he basically tells her, if you don't give me this railroad pass, I'm going to spill some piping hot tea that I've learned about you through our sittings.
And she said nothing.
Everyone's already gossiping about her.
She's done nothing, though.
People would buy it because people in Washington loved gossip. So it really was a serious threat.
Okay.
And she was taking it very seriously.
Okay.
So Brooks basically tells her, you know what? Don't worry. I've got a plan. It's okay. I've got a plan. Why don't you just tell Colchester to come to the White House and come see you? It's fine. So she tells Colchester to come over to the White House. And when he arrives, Mrs. Lincoln introduces him to Brooks, who he actually doesn't recognize.
Oh,
because
amazing.
The room was probably really dim. Even amazing. When the lights were on, he doesn't recognize him. So Brooks actually wrote later, after I had been formally introduced to the charlatan, Mrs. Lincoln.
Oh, the charlatan.
The charlatan.
Oh, that's very delicious.
Mrs. Lincoln withdrew from the room. Going up to Colchester, I lifted the hair from the scar on my forehead, yet unhealed, and said, do you recognize this? The man muttered something about his having been insulted. And then I said, you know that I know that you are a swindler and a humbug.
Oh, hell yes.
Yes.
I like humbug because also I don't know what that means. And it seems great.
Get out of this house and out of town at once.
I agree.
If you were in Washington tomorrow afternoon at this time, you will be at the old Capitol prison. The little scamp pulled himself together and sneaked out of the house and is, so far as I know, out of Washington. I never saw or heard of him afterward.
The little scamp.
The little scamp.
like
the little rascal.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm not going to worry myself with this little scamp.
So Colchester, he ran away. And in the fall of that same year, this is 1865, in the fall, he was convicted in upstate New York of jugglery, which basically means like sleight of hand. Probably like card tricks or something like magic without a license.
Okay.
Yeah. And then he died in Iowa a few years later. Sometime before all of this, before he was exposed as a fraud, before he was run out of Washington, Colchester warned the president, warned Abraham Lincoln of assassination. We don't actually know. We do not know what he knew.
But he was friends with Wilkes Booth.
Absolutely.
Who killed Lincoln.
Yes.
So
we don't know for a fact because we never got the chance to interview Colchester after Lincoln's death. I mean, because Colchester was a psychic, and they were usually just going off of educated guesses.
That's not a real thing.
So it's possible that he might have just been guessing because other psychics were telling Lincoln the same thing.
He didn't need to be psychic. He just needs to have ears.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah. When
I'm sorry.
No, you shouldn't be sorry.
What?
No, this is absolutely the correct.
This is not real.
reaction. When a friend of Lincoln's told him, like, dude, you need to fucking watch out. You need to have more security. Lincoln, his answer, Colchester has been telling me that. But again, Colchester was not the only spiritualist who was telling Lincoln that. It didn't take a fucking psychic
exactly.
to see that the Confederacy was desperate.
You did not need a spiritualist. You just need someone who was looking at you.
Yeah.
Period. No. The end.
It's absolutely possible that Colchester had firsthand knowledge, but we don't know that for sure.
We don't
but
know that
we
for sure.
know
yeah.
is that it didn't fucking take a psychic
no.
to see what was going on, the writing on the wall.
Exactly.
But Lincoln didn't take it seriously, didn't take Colchester's warning seriously. He didn't take anyone's warning seriously. So many people were telling him. But Lincoln told one friend, I do not believe that it is my fate to die in this way. And then
he didn't know the future.
He told another friend.
Oh no.
Quote, I cannot be shut up in an iron cage and guarded. A president must go among the people. One man's life is as dear to him as another's. And if a man takes my life, he may be reasonably sure that he will lose his own. So his thinking was, nobody's going to kill me because they don't want to die.
Exactly, yeah. And I do get that because that is logical. But at the same time, that's not like a murderous logic at all.
People who are assassinating presidents are not thinking that way. Because it's like,
I want to kill you. Yeah, exactly. And like, I don't care what happens to
me.
Like,
exactly.
They say, I am nobody.
Yeah, exactly.
But I got you.
Yeah. And so we all know how all it all worked out for Lincoln.
Lincoln is so sweet. We all know.
So Booth shot Lincoln on April 14th, 1865 at Ford's Theater.
Yeah.
And almost immediately afterwards, a military policeman was sent to ask questions at Booth's hotel. And the room clerk at the hotel told him about Booth's close friendship with Colchester. But it was too late. Snitching. Colchester had already left town.
Of course.
He couldn't be found, so we never got the chance to ask him what he knew or didn't know about the plot to kill the president.
Yeah.
And then, like I said, Colchester died just a few years later in Iowa. Nobody knew where the fuck he was. Unfortunately, life for Mary Todd Lincoln just got worse and worse after this. So for one thing, she was already in a fragile state from the deaths of her two sons and her mother at a young age. When she sat and watched her husband be shot point blank in the head right in front of her.
Wow.
Right in front of her. Wow. Point blank in the back of the head. And before he died, he was carried to a nearby home. Originally, they wanted to carry him to the White House, but it was too far and they knew he would die before he got there. So they're like, okay, there's a home over here. This guy said it's okay. Let's carry him into this guy's home. And maybe we can save him. Called the doctor, called some government officials. Come over. Mary Todd Lincoln was in hysterics. Freaking the fuck out. As you would be. Edwin Stanton, the Secretary of War that you may remember from the Andrew Johnson episode. The impeachment episode that I talked about. He shows up. And Mary Todd Lincoln cannot calm down. She is just screaming and wailing and freaking the fuck out.
Her husband was shot in the head.
It's not unjustified what she's doing, but the doctor is trying to operate.
Yeah,
people are trying to talk to him, and nobody can fucking do anything because Mary Todd Lincoln is just in the background like,
women are the worst. Women are the worst.
Yeah,
they ruin everything, as Tux is saying.
Yeah, no, it is completely justified. how she's reacting.
I am joking.
But so Edwin Stanton throws her out of the room, will not let her in the room because she can't calm down. So Lincoln died and she was not in the room. And she never got to say goodbye because Edwin Stanton wouldn't let her back in the room. And, like I've already said, back then, social custom was that upper-class women were not supposed to show emotion in public. But Mary Todd Lincoln could not contain her grief, even after the death, well after the death, after the funeral, whatever.
Good for her.
She could not contain her grief. On top of all of everything that she was going through, everything, all the loss, everything. And on top of
it's
it,
like she was human.
Some mental health experts who have read about her also think that she may have also been bipolar on top of everything that was going on. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of mental health experts have read about what happened with her and think that she may have been bipolar. On top of everything that was going on in her life, no one was trying to help her.
Women don't have feelings and I'm not shocked that no one was trying to help her.
Yeah.
At all.
Instead, what they were doing was talking shit about her behind her back.
Of course.
They were saying, most of the society women in Washington were saying that she had an unladylike craving for attention after her husband's death.
Wow.
So she leaves the White House. She actually moved into a hotel in Chicago.
Oh,
I mean, the family was from Illinois originally but she probably wanted to get the fuck out of Washington because they couldn't keep her mouth out of their fucking names or mouths. They couldn't keep
her name out of their mouths.
Exactly. Thank you. One of us said it.
Yeah.
Keep her mouth out of their mouth. Keep her name out of their mouths.
There we go. I'm like, ta-da! No, that's not right.
They could not keep her name out of their mouths.
Correct.
And the rumor mill just kept on fucking turning and getting worse and worse. So she's like, fuck this, I'm going to Chicago. But it didn't improve when she got to Chicago. A former law partner of Lincoln's actually tried to, he accused her of not being a Christian. And then he leaked some
weird... She's promiscuous and excessively fertile.
I mean... I was like, was she? No. Yeah.
Was she? It doesn't matter.
Nope, it didn't matter. Yeah. And then he, the same law partner, leaked some weird shitty gossip about the Lincoln's marriage to the newspapers.
In what respect, though?
I don't even fully know the story because, again, I didn't have the fucking mental...
But also... You know it was lies.
It's bullshit.
Yeah.
And then Mary Todd Lincoln tried to be like, hey, that's fucking bullshit.
Yeah.
And the newspapers were like, Mary Todd Lincoln has publicly disputed this story. And that is unladylike and improper of her to do.
Yes.
And she also had some pretty serious financial troubles because she was kind of a shopaholic.
Yes. Yeah. There's like separate scandals about that.
Yes. But so... She had all these financial troubles, and the papers just would not leave her alone.
Yeah.
And one historian actually said, the press attacks were more brutal than her bleakest days at the White House.
I believe that.
So she ended up going to Congress and asking Congress for a widow's pension.
No one cares.
And Congress was like, no. New phone, who dis?
Yeah.
The bottom line was they were saying that William Henry Harrison's wife didn't get a pension when he died.
Yeah.
But William Henry Harrison served 1 month before he died of pneumonia.
No,
Lincoln died because he was murdered for being president.
Yes.
Like, there's no comparison. None.
Yeah.
It's bullshit.
The courts, as we've learned, are bullshit.
Yeah, absolutely. But so Charles Sumner actually stepped up. And stood up to Congress and said, you give this fucking woman a pension.
Really?
It took a couple of years, but he made it happen. She got a pension because of Charles Sumner.
He's the one who got beat up, though.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah, okay. He's like, I've already been beat to death.
This fucking bitch some money.
What can they do to me?
Yeah, exactly. But of course, throughout all of this, she was still seeing spiritualists and paying spiritualists while she's having financial trouble.
Of course, including a
quote, spirit photographer.
What does that mean?
He faked a photo of Lincoln standing behind her with his hands on her shoulder. His ghost standing behind her with his hands on her shoulder. And she fucking loved it. She completely bought it, hook, line, and sinker, loved it. And the photo somehow was distributed to the country. And people loved the shit. The whole country
loved this photo.
I will put this photo on Instagram.
Oh, no.
We do not know, or I don't know. Maybe somebody does. Maybe if you do know, please tell us. I don't know if the photographer leaked it to the public for money or if she did because she loved it so much.
Okay.
Both are possible. She loved this photo. She really believed
that Lincoln's spirit
was with her. But unfortunately, 1 year later, after this photo was taken... A third son died.
Stop it.
Her son Tad died, and she was forced to move in with her only remaining son, her oldest son Robert. So she continued to see more mediums. She continued to more seances. She often went to seances under assumed names because Robert actually forbade her from going to seances. So she started going under an assumed name. But people knew who the fuck she was.
Of course.
And then the papers would catch wind of it.
Of course.
And they would publish these awful, shitty articles about, crazy old Mary Todd Lincoln is at another seance again. And then a few years later in 1875, her son Robert had her arrested and committed to a sanitarium. Because he said that she was squandering.
Feeble-minded.
Yes. She was feeble-minded. Yeah. He said that she was...
Feeble-minded is everyone. Everyone is feeble-minded.
She was squandering their estate on spiritualists.
Oh, fuck you. Yeah. Fuck you.
So she was in the sanitarium for over a year before she was released. Mary Todd Lincoln.
Wow.
In a fucking sanitarium for over a year before she was released.
A long time.
And then when she finally got out, she was like, fuck all y'all.
Obviously.
And she moved to Europe. She was like, this is garbage. Fuck all y'all.
Yeah.
She did end up moving back to the U.S. kind of towards the end, moved in with her sister in Illinois, but she was only there for about a year or so before she died of a stroke at age 63.
So young.
So young. Wow. In 1882. Today, we might look back and see Mary Todd Lincoln's behavior at this time as a sign of the horrific trauma and intense tragedy and loss and loneliness that she was experiencing during her life. Mm-hmm. Or we could even see it as potentially evidence of her possible bipolar disorder. But instead, what I learned when I was researching this story is that most people, what they choose to focus on, her husband is running around the White House spying on Winston Churchill in the bathtub. That's what everybody's talking about.
Oh, gross.
Lincoln's ghost is peeping on Winston Churchill in the bathtub. The end.
Okay.
Happy Halloween.
Happy air quotes. Yeah. Halloween. Teehee.
Teehee.
I thought I knew about that story, but I did not know about all of this.
Yeah.
Like, not even close.
Well, yeah, so that's the fucking tragic tale of Mary Todd Lincoln. It's crazy to me that when I first started to look at the story, I thought it was just like, oh, isn't it funny that there were seances in the White House?
There are, like, ghosts in the White House.
And I had no idea how deep it was until I started looking into it, and I was like, oh, shit, this story is not nearly as fun as I thought it was going to be, but it's worth telling. Yeah. Especially for Halloween. I was like, I have to do it anyways. It's fucking dark.
Yeah.
It's not even dark. It's just like, it's real.
It is real. Yeah. People didn't really care about the loss that was experienced by women.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
They were just like, oh, she's crazy, or she needs to get, like, with the program. Like, move on.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Really fucked up. And just history really doesn't tell the story of women.
No. Women need to have these stories told. And
yeah.
And
like, being emotional, air quotes emotional, like, just feeling the loss.
Yeah.
Feeling the real loss that you've experienced is like, oh, she's being emotional. Mm-hmm. Or he's being emotional.
Yeah. And well, that was the whole thing. That's why people turned to spiritualists in the first place. Because this was the only way that they knew how to deal with emotions that they weren't allowed to have.
Yeah. So our drinks are empty. At least my drink is empty.
I could turn it upside down. This shit has been empty because I needed all the liquor for this.
Yeah, and it was so delicious. So, like, as you were telling your story, I'm just like, glub, 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 glub. Yeah. So American history is juicy. We just add gin and orange juice and real grenadine. And, yeah.
Absinthe.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my
God.
We're
gonna get crazy.
That's true. No, the absinthe was a surprisingly, like, heavy hitter in
that. Consider, like, it's just, like, a few dashes of it.
It's, like, a drop of it, but, like, it made the cocktail for me, at least.
Yeah. No, 100%.
So thank you so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Stephanie Domingo.
Tux Lurzel.
Thank you to Tim Clough, our editor, our sound engineer, our podfather. We could not do this without him. Cheers.
Bye.
Bye. Beyond Reproach is proudly recorded in Bushwick, Brooklyn. New episodes are released the first and third Monday of every month. Please note that we are not historians. We are just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. Full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop at beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. We are on Patreon if anyone would love to show us some love and throw us some nickels to support the production of our show.